Hello and welcome to another episode of the Marshall Spotlight Podcast. Today it's International Women's Day, and I am joined by a guest co-host in Avlev, who has been on this podcast quite a few times now. And the guest today is Umar. Hello, both.
Hi.
Hello.
So I did try and understand how to say Umar's name properly because it's a lot longer than just that. Just want to give you your full name, and then obviously we'll talk about what you're currently doing today and who you are.
Sure. So, hi, everyone. My name is Umayal Palaniappan. I go by Uma for short. I am currently a strategy manager at Rolls-Royce PLC, located here in the UK. I'm based in our Derby site. And I have forgotten the second half of Andrew's question now.
Just to share, we're talking about, you know, what you do in the day-to-day.
What I do in the day-to-day. Okay. So my role is to work across the Rolls-Royce group with different stakeholders, answering complex questions with regards to our corporate strategy. So for the moment, I am looking at our digital and IT strategy. So I work with the chief digital and information officers, as well as key stakeholders across the business, with regards to what we're going to do in the future around our digital and IT.
Awesome. So I've never actually worked directly with Rolls-Royce, but I did work with one of your partners many, many moons ago, the Manufacturing Technology Centre in Coventry. So I was there, so I was obviously supporting some of the staff that were basically coming in and obviously doing work and all the different machinery there, which even to this day, I still don't understand half the machinery that is still there. But yeah, it was a good night. I think about 2 years I was there. So I got to meet lots of different people in Rolls-Royce during that time.
It's a really cool site, isn't it? It's our Advanced Manufacturing Research Center. And I went there when it first opened and I was a graduate. And it was really cool because essentially what we do there is we have different technology and we have to take technology through different maturity levels before it can become a productionized. So that's where they go and experiment, and lots of very clever people work there.
Yeah, so the insane thing is that when I first went there, it was just a single building on the site. And I think my staff number was like 34 or something like that, because that's how many people were actually there at the time. Obviously, I know I've left there since, and I know that basically what they've done to the whole entire site now is completely mental. There's so many different buildings doing so many different things. And I got a lot of time for the MTC because they gave me a lot of opportunities to what I'm currently doing today. So I'm forever grateful for being there. And I say, I got to do some really cool things being there as well. I mean, was now the world's fastest steam car, the British big green steam car. They had that in the reception once. So I got to actually to sit inside that and help do a 3-point turn, which turned to be like a 100-point turn because it's designed to go forward, not left and right. So it was interesting. So obviously now we learned obviously a little bit about Rolls-Royce. Let's talk about obviously your life prior to Rolls-Royce. So talking at the very start, so where did you come from and from like, school life going upwards?
So I have had a really cool life. Well, cool to me at least. So I was born in Malaysia and because my father worked in the government service, my family moved a lot. So depending on where he was stationed, we moved. So whilst I was born in Malaysia, I spent some formative years in London and then returned to Malaysia and then lived in different parts of the country. I went to university there and then I came across to read for my master's here in the UK. I went back to Malaysia and got my first job out of university there. And whilst I'd been here in the UK, I'd applied for jobs. And when I got back to Malaysia and started working, I was invited to interview at Rolls-Royce on the grad scheme. And I came across, did the interview, flew back. And when I landed, they'd called me to say, we'll see you in September. So, you know, fast forward 19 and a half years. Here I am, still in Derby.
Are you based in Derby?
Yes, I am based in Derby.
Me too, almost.
Yeah, you're close by, aren't you? You're somewhere a little more picturesque.
It's a beautiful town called Belper.
Which is not very far at all. Very pretty.
So with the that move from obviously Malaysia, obviously that's a lot of moving around and obviously completely different culture style. So how did you find all that kind of like transitioning into the good old Derby, into the Midlands?
Especially a bit of weather.
So weather's always an interesting topic, isn't it? So I think to start with, I think culture is probably a more interesting subject. So I don't remember being in Malaysia up to the age of two, right? Because you're young, you have some formative ideas. So I think the first move for me, or conscious move, was when I moved from the UK back to Malaysia at the age of six. And I remember, you know, you have core memories, right? So I remember this small little anecdote where people would ask me, are you excited about moving to Malaysia? And I'll go, no, because there are bees there. Because I was clearly very afraid of bees and thought there'd be bees everywhere and I didn't really want to move. I'd miss my friends and all of that. But clearly bees were all the most interesting thing for me to be afraid about. But moving to Malaysia, what became apparent once I got there was that my English had a British accent. And in Malaysia, everyone spoke Malaysian English and had a Malaysian accent. And so I was teased for not being able to be understood. I started school. The medium in school is Bahasa Melayu, which is the national language. Malay is what we would call it in English. The entire education system is in Malay except for English, at least when I went to school. Things have changed back and forth over the years. And so I remember going to school and I came home and I asked my dad, oh, the teacher called me this word, what does this word mean? And I've never seen my father be in such a rage before. You know, he marched into school and got into an argument with the teacher because the teacher essentially called me stupid because she would speak to me in class. I wouldn't understand anything she was saying because it was a language I didn't speak. I failed all my first few tests that I had because everything was in Malay. But then, you know, you're a kid. You pick it up, you read books, you engage with friends, and you learn the language pretty quickly. And so I then became fluent in Malay. And the rest of my education was done in Malay up till university as well. Even university was done in Malay.
Oh, wow.
So that's a big change for me.
So obviously with your early life, so what like got you into the world of IT? What was the first initial driver?
Go on, Ed.
So raising up in a country which is patriotic, so yes. How did it affect your careers and goals in the life? Because I have the same experience. I born and raised in Turkey, and tech is man-dominated, let's say. So when I was reading your questionnaire, I was like, oh my God, I fought really hard to get what I need.
Yeah. So there's a slight dichotomy, really, with that, in the sense that my dad is very technologically savvy. So when we were here in the UK, he joined a little hackers club, a computer club, really. But
not anonymous, was it?
No, not anonymous. This was back in the early 1980s, right? We're talking about floppy disk drives in BBC computers. But he joined a computer club because my dad's always been, my father's a surgeon, but he's always very technologically savvy. So it was his interest, really. And he brought back a BBC computer to our home. And I remember doing maths problems on this computer in our living room, in our basement flat in London back in the early 1980s. And so a computer in the home, I was very privileged. I've always had a computer in my home because my dad used it to do all of his report writing for his medical case notes. He built his own databases to store all of his patient information so it was easier for him to organize his taxes. he did all of that at home on a home computer. So I grew up with a computer, and I didn't really know life without it, I suppose. When the internet came along, I still remember writing emails to my uncle who lives in the US, and he is also very technologically savvy. And so this was when you didn't have email addresses. It was a whole bunch of series of dots and numbers, and you got one wrong and the email wouldn't arrive to them, right? But it was so cool. I did all of these things, and I really owe it a lot to my dad. So whilst I grew up in a very patriarchal society where, you know, women are expected to be more focused around the home and home life, I also had a dad who was very committed to making sure that I was educated and independent of thought and able to survive on my own. But he would, you know, also want me to have a focus on a home life. So it was, it's complex, right? It's not straightforward. It's like, what does society and culture expect of you? And he expected those things of me and probably still does. But then at the same time, he gave me these tools and showed me a glimpse of what was possible beyond that. So I guess I became my own person, and like all teenagers, rebelled a lot and kind of fought my way to do what I wanted to do.
I was about to comment on that because I am the rebel of my family. You know that they expect you to just go to the best university, and my parents told me I can either be an engineer or a medical doctor because the rest was in that economical situation, you cannot survive. So I did that. So then I got engaged, get married, and I was like, no, this is not me. So I was the first woman who got divorced in the family. I don't know if I'm a good example or not, but I can totally relate with everything you said.
Yeah, so I actually wanted to study medicine. I really wanted to be a doctor. I didn't actually want to go into IT necessarily. It wasn't that I didn't want to. It wasn't my dream, right? My dream was to be a doctor. And it was a very complex time economically when I finished secondary school. I had a much younger brother, and my parents had to make some choices, right? And in Malaysia, there is an affirmative action system when it comes to education and most things in the country. And my experience of that was affirmative action isn't for the minorities, it's actually for the majority there. So it's a bit different. It's because the majority is considered to be more economically disadvantaged, and therefore the affirmative action is for the majority. And so there were very few places in university for me to study medicine if I went through the local university system. And I kind of had to hedge my bets. Do I try the lottery? And I wanted to also have a bit of fun, right? I didn't want to just be 100% studious. I wanted to go and do all the extracurricular activities and hang out with friends and all the stuff that anybody who's 17 years old wants to do. So I didn't end up pursuing the local university route for medicine. I signed up for computer science instead.
Obviously, while I was at university, obviously you did quite a few different things as well, didn't you?
Yes.
Obviously, you was elected the International Society Social Secretary.
Oh, yes. I did that when I was here at Loughborough. Yes.
What is that?
I was basically a glorified party planner.
Right, wicked.
Yeah, social secretary. So when you're an international student and you go to a foreign country, you find that your friends who are native to that country doesn't necessarily, regardless of their background, have an existing social circle. They have friends from home, or they have family to see, or they have things that are in common with each other. And so when you come with an international perspective, you have to find community. And I think that's what the International Society was about for me. It was about belonging and inclusion and creating a community. And I think that's always been important to me, actually, now that you've asked that question. And so Social Secretary was just a way of doing it. I was fun. I enjoyed partying. And so I was Social Secretary to organize a whole lot of different events. It was really good fun and a really good way to find your community when you're in a place that isn't naturally your home.
Yeah, I think obviously, I think many people have spoke to this on the podcast. It's like when you move from a different country to another, you haven't got that support network that you grew up with, you know, is the norm. So when you move to another country, it's obviously that transition phase of getting used to the culture, the style, the different people that you're working with or just being associated with does take a bit of time. It takes a certain person to be able to walk into the room and, you know, be accepted.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've said it quite a few times, like when I do that within my life, so, you know, I run a football team, so I have to deal with different parents, different coaches. I'm also on the committee for the league as well, so I'm having to deal with lots of different people. What I try and do is just assess the person and become like a bit of a chameleon. So I refer to it as like a social chameleon, so I can adapt myself to the situation that I'm in, because I'm from a very much working class background, but I'll obviously work in an environment where I talk to directors, CEOs, upwards. So I've always tried and basically put myself in a position where I can just go, well, he's at that level, so I'll just step myself up and find something that I can basically talk about myself and go and engage him that way. Because I've done a lot of interesting things in the past, and some of my hobbies are quite interesting. So it's a first way of breaking the ice and then going forward.
Yeah, it's I call that code switching, right? So I do that a lot. So like when I'm back in Malaysia, my accent is completely back to being Malaysian. And then when I'm here, I, you know, speak with a British accent. And it is, yeah. And then when you deal with different people, I think you learn as well as a person who is of color, that you adapt yourself to the situation to make it easier on yourself to assimilate, right? Because I think the expectation is always for us to assimilate rather than it is for the situation to include us.
Yeah.
Cultural translator, I call it.
Oh, that's a cool term.
I think everyone has their own little way of like describing it to some way, and it really is just very much, you know, how you perceive yourself to the outside world. Go on, Avliv.
So being a sister, being a mom, being a neurodiverse person, and I actually, thanks to you, I learned what it cishet meant. And you are also doing mentoring, coaching. So how do you balance that? Because that's a lot of work, and I can basically see you are an overachiever, outstanding overachiever. Oh. This is what we call in Microsoft.
Thank you, Alev. That's very kind. I think the coaching and mentoring is actually what gives me balance, right? So I search for it because it allows me to, it's a two-way street, right, when I coach and mentor, because it means that space that I've created for myself and my mentee, or for me and my mentor, is a safe space, right? And that means that you recharge in that space. And so it gives me balance. And so I try to make time to, and I really don't make enough time to do it, honestly. I wish I could make more time to do it because it's so fulfilling, and it gives me a lot of energy, actually, when I speak to someone else who trusts me to share their dilemma, and then we try and work through it together, or I can go to them. Sometimes I go to my mentees actually and go, I've got this problem. What would you do? Well, I've got this challenge. How would you approach it? And they help me. So it is a two-way street. And I think it is, that's how I do it, I guess.
Reverse coaching. I think, so I am a millennial. And now Gen Z is up there doing all the social media related things. And sometimes, and they are very keen on doing things, learning things. They are very easy to adapt to everything. Sometimes I ping our apprentice colleagues and I'm like, how would you do things? Like, what should I do differently? And they are brilliant.
Oh, yeah, they are. I mean, even as simple as we were doing a planning session the other day internally, and one of our other team members went, oh, you know, there's this tool that we can use instead. I was like, really? Wow. Okay. Yes. Teach me how to use it. And I'm a bit clunky and, you know, it took me a little while to get the hang of it. And then now I have, and all of us are using it within the team, and it's just made our lives so much easier. So yeah, I think the younger generation or the Gen Z or it's just the, it's how technology is moving forward and how their finger is so on the pulse with it, right? That they move with it. And I used to think when I was a kid, oh, I don't understand how come older people don't know how to use computers. It's so easy. And then now I'm this older person and I think I'm asking the 11-year-olds, what's that and how do you use it? And can you show me what to do with it? And it's cool.
I've got a question for you. So we're talking about obviously like the present day. Mm. Obviously you started at Rolls Royce 19 years ago.
Yes, yes.
A long time.
It is a long time.
So, I mean, what has been the main driver for you staying at Rolls Royce? Because obviously 19 years, I know in my company where I work, there's a lot of people have been here for like 20 plus years. And I've had that conversation of why they stay. So what's made you stay at Rolls Royce for that period of time?
I think I've always had the chance to go and do something different and interesting, right? So I've spent 19 and a bit years here, but I've not done the same thing the whole time, right? So it's given me the opportunity to move and change and do different divisions, different businesses, different interactions, different levels within the organization. And I've stayed because there's always been an interesting challenge. And the people at Rolls-Royce are some of the cleverest people you will ever meet anywhere. And I really enjoy that. And they're very generous with their knowledge. They're very engaging with it. So I can go and sit down with someone and say, hey, you know about this. I don't know about this. Can you spend the time and talk me through it? And they do. So the company has that culture of sharing knowledge, which is incredibly powerful, which means that people don't feel the need to know everything. We just need to pull the right people into the room and we will get a better answer. And I think that's a great culture to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I think any workplace where it obviously keeps staff retention like that for, you know, for many years demonstrates how well the company's operating and how well they're doing internally. Because I think at Microsoft as well, there's so many people that basically they've been there for like a million years that don't see themselves ever moving away because they're so ingrained in the vision of the business, the culture, that why look elsewhere? And I'm sure Avle will basically agree on that. I don't think she ever sees herself leaving Microsoft either.
How long have you been with Microsoft now, Avle?
I joined more than 9 years ago in Microsoft Turkey, and I did the same. So I actually asked my mentor how you can survive in a company like Microsoft and just thrive, do your best self, do the best business. He told me either I need to follow a leader or follow my passion. So I joined as exchange premier field engineer, which has been changed like 5 or 6 times the names. So we change everything.
It's Microsoft. They always change names for everything. So, you know.
Yeah. Change is constant, right?
Yeah. Change is constant. And this is actually making me adapt like a Clement or chameleon really fast. Then I joined our consulting services and became the first principal consultant in the modern work in the world. And then everything's changed again. I became a solution architect. Now I am a modern work technical specialist. And I love working for Microsoft.
I think it really shows. And it's really nice when you meet someone from a company and you can really see and hear the passion that they have for the brand and the work and the people. And I think that's very telling.
Two things that I do value are mission, empower every organization and every person in the planet to achieve more. And like Satya says, and I joined a few months later when Satya became our CEO, we are here to make you cool, make you look cool, not us. Literally, we want our customers to shine.
That's a really cool mission.
I think obviously the most important thing about obviously both businesses that you work for is that diverse culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know, I know from experience from dealing with Rolls Royce how diverse the staff are there, because obviously they're all engineers, they're all coming through from different parts of the world and sharing that knowledge and experience obviously helps build that Rolls Royce brand, same as Microsoft. I mean, just want to talk us about, you know, how diverse your team is, what's the ratio between males and females?
So it varies, right, within Rolls-Royce. So I was very fortunate when I mentioned I came across on a graduate scheme. Rolls-Royce was one of the very few companies back in early 2000s that had an international graduate scheme, right, because it involved getting work permits for someone who wasn't a British national to come and work here. So very, very fortunate on that side. And then the diversity within Rolls-Royce it depends. It's pockets, it's areas, it's subjects. And in my current team and strategy, the diversity is we're probably about 30% female. We're a very small team, so 30%. Female. So that's higher than our average across the company. I think our company average is about 19% female.
How have you seen that since joining Rolls-Royce? Has that number increased or decreased, or is this basically been like a balanced medium?
I think it depends, is probably the answer, because when I worked in the more manufacturing and side of things, I remember being in our final engine assembly factory, and there were four women in the entire building, myself included. And there were about, 200 men. So the ratio really does depend. Over the years, it has changed. The diversity has increased between males and females, but again, it depends. If you worked in, for example, certain areas like perhaps finance or HR, you might come across more women, but not necessarily always in manufacturing. So in manufacturing, it definitely increased. In engineering, the numbers have increased, and I think now there are also more women than there used to be in management. But over 20 years, you expect to see these changes as well, right? So
yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And so I know in the organization that I work for, you know, there was a lot of female leaders that have been there from the very start as an apprentice stroke graduate, and then basically worked their way up.
Yeah. So it changes, it varies. Sometimes we find that women are more concentrated in certain levels of the organization, either because they elect to stay within that area, or there are fewer opportunities for progression sometimes, depending on the timescales, or there are or people leave, right? Because they're looking for something different. So then the demographic is constantly changing.
Cool. And with this episode, obviously talking about International Women's Day, what does the term mean to you? Obviously, you know, it's been going on for many years now and have obviously different themes every year. So what does it mean for you for this year?
So International Women's Day holds a very complex space for me. So I believe in its ethos, right? It's the stride towards equity and justice. The complexity for me is that I find that it often lacks the intersectionality that we need to really empower all women. I think it can sometimes be focused on the experiences of privileged women, and therefore the struggles of marginalized groups are less seen and heard. And so it can sometimes perpetuate existing inequalities rather than solving it for the, or amplifying voices for people who need it the most. So I do, it holds a complex space. I believe in it, in its ethos, but yeah, I struggle with it.
Yeah, I mean, this year's theme's called Inspire Inclusion. So it's when others inspire to understand the value of women's inclusion and help forge a better world.
And I think that's key, isn't it? So whilst I you know, say it's complex and I struggle with it, there is so much that we can do, right? So it's a super powerful platform, I think, to amplify diverse voices. And then that is very much in line with the theme. So we need to listen to stories and seek out understanding of those who are less represented, so we can challenge narratives and, you know, try and find solutions that work for all women and all the marginalized, disproportionately affected groups within that, rather than I suppose individuals. It has to be collective.
Yeah.
So, and also talks about how to become the good ally within either technical work or workplace. So what was the best moment if you had an ally? And will you please explain it a little bit?
An ally in the organization. Yes, I had a fantastic ally at one point. She's still my mentor. She's also my friend. She's retired from Rolls Royce now, actually. And this is a very small thing, but it was incredibly meaningful for me. So she was awarded the Women in Science and Engineering Lifetime Achievement Award back in 2015. Yeah, a super, super incredible woman. She was one of our first female chief engineers in Rolls Royce, and she was my mentor. We're still good friends, despite the fact that she's retired from Rolls-Royce. And she was a great ally in the sense that when she was given this award, she couldn't make it because she retired and she'd already planned a holiday and she was off somewhere in South America. And
priorities.
Yeah, priorities. And I love that she did that, right? I love that she went, I'm going to go because I'm there and that's what I'm going to do. So she organized for me to collect the award on her behalf, which was incredible for me because the award was being given by Her Royal Highness Princess Anne.
Okay, cool.
Wow.
I think that's how she's correctly addressed. We might need to check that one.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not great with the royal family either.
Yeah. So it was by Her Royal Highness. So I, you know, was incredibly privileged to go in her stead rather than somebody else in the organization. And she fought for me to do so.
Oh, okay.
Because they intended to send someone more senior within the organization to go and accept the award. And she felt it was important that it was a woman. And she felt that it, because it was women in science and engineering, and she felt it was important that it was someone who represented her. And I thought that was an incredible opportunity for me to go and accept the honor on her behalf. And Her Royal Highness asked me, so will we actually see you up here, you know, when it comes your time? And I remember saying, I certainly hope so. So it was, yeah, kind of cool. So she was an incredible ally, not just because of, you know, the fact that I got to go and receive an award on her behalf, but the fact that she spoke up when the organization wanted to send a different representative and went, no, no, I would like to send my mentee, because she believed in mentorship and she believed in amplifying diverse voices and amplifying a diverse person in a space that would otherwise have been probably someone else in my organization instead.
So with the culture then within Rolls-Royce for mentorship, allyship, is there set groups that people can join, or is it something that's basically naturally organic where people just do it within the business?
So there are both. So there are formal and informal structures. I think if you are part of getting your like IMEKI or one of these different technical mentorships, there's a bit more of a scheme internally within the organization where there will be different people of different levels of accreditation that you can go and become mentors with, but get mentorship from. But with regards to this, we are more organic about it. Everybody mentors and they make time to do so. Though there are, so different groups sometimes, so the way myself and Liz, who was my mentor at the time, got connected was through, at the time we had an employee resource group called Women's Network. We now have renamed that. It's the Gender Diversity Network. But at that point, it was called the Women's Network. And as part of the Women's Network, we had an opportunity to apply for being a mentor and being mentored. And I got matched up with Liz. And, you know, she's been my mentor and friend now for, geez, at least 15 years. So, you know, a long time.
Just one thing. I've been given a different feedbacks about becoming a friend in a workplace, because I do believe in friendship. So Andy knows about Chris Wheeler. He is one of the best allies that I have ever had. And whenever he thinks that someone is being disrespectful against my skills, he says, this is not right. So I actually forgot what I'm going from.
Friends in the workplace.
Do you believe in friendship in workplace? I got too many notifications at the same
time. That's quite all right. So when I said that Liz became my friend, I think it was something that developed very slowly over time, right? I think the reality is the workplace is a professional workplace. And so the intricacies of friendship is very different. Now that Liz is retired, we are more friends because we choose to spend time with one another. And I guess that's the difference, right? The contract between you is different. When you're at work, the contract is still professional. If someone asks for help, you have a duty of care to provide that help, right? Where else, if you're choosing to do it in your own time outside of work, then that's where friendship accounts for it. Yeah. But can you have friends in the workplace? Yes, I think you can. And it happens to be that with Derby being quite a small town, a lot of people are friends and they happen to work at Rolls-Royce, but they may not necessarily be in the same team, right? You might have met playing tennis. You might have met, you know, some of the ladies I know who would never have come across each other within Rolls-Royce in their working day-to-day lives meet in a prenatal class or something like that, that, you know, and then they become friends. And yeah, there are different walks of life even within a large company like Rolls-Royce, just because of the amount of people we have.
For people, say in my situation where, you know, I am home working 100% of the time, it's obviously more of a challenge to build that kind of friendship. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first joined my company, there was another guy that joined at the same time as me. And I think we basically built up a good rapport with each other because we had shared experiences. We both joined Fujitsu during COVID. Then it was like, well, I'm trying to learn what to do from the whole business. He's trying to do the exact same thing. And I think from that, we kind of like very much helped each other all the way through. And then obviously now the world's opened up again. We don't talk as much as we did. So, I mean, and obviously probably because of our work schedules as well, I think it is more challenging if you're in a role where it's probably hybrid, where you don't get to go out into the office and see people on a regular basis to kind of build that friendship level up with people.
It is different, right? You have to make time, I think, in your hybrid relationships to kind of go, let's meet up or let's have a virtual coffee. It takes more effort. And then you also kind of go, oh, we're both sat on, you know, looking at the screen, talking to each other. Interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, one of my colleagues from a previous role, we were going to try and meet up when we were both on site at the same time, but we couldn't get our diaries to work. So we both went for a walk, but we were not together. So we had a walking meeting on our own, but headphones and talking to one another.
Oh, okay.
That's good. I don't think it's right. But yeah, we had a walking meeting, but he was walking where he lived and I was walking where I live.
We do encourage to going out and have a walk to improve your mental fitness a lot in Microsoft. Next time, let me know if I'm around.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I do try when people are, when we're not having to sit and look at a spreadsheet together or work on a PowerPoint together or something, then walking and talking is fantastic.
I think we are getting close to our like usual runtime, so I've got a couple of questions I'm going to throw out there towards like the end of the episode.
Sure.
If you could go back and speak to your younger self before you transitioned over to the UK, what advice would you give yourself?
I had the same.
Oh, that's such a good question. I think it would very much be that you are... you are worth it. You are confident. You're intelligent. You are everything that you aspire to be, and you can absolutely do it. Just stay the course. That's what I would probably tell myself.
Okay, cool. And another one I've started to bring up recently, and if you haven't heard this question yet, is if I stood in an elevator with you now and you had to give me a pitch about the culture at Rolls-Royce, what would you say?
Oh, what I would say about the culture at Rolls-Royce?
Yeah, in a short elevator pitch.
Elevator pitch. Ooh, interesting. So the culture at Rolls-Royce is constantly changing and constantly moving, right? It is adapting to the needs and changes of what's going on in the world around us. And so it is always grounded in collaboration. It is grounded in doing the best that we can do. But it is also in need of challenging norms, and it is also in need of the way we pioneer in technology. I think we also need to pioneer in culture.
Awesome. Avleth, do you have anything you want to throw in there right at the end?
No, it's just I was actually using Copilot to compare what is the diversity rate in Microsoft because I joined in 2014, now it's 2024, and you, Uma, your team is actually the same level. So we have 31.6% of diversity. What would be like one of the advice you have been given to help you shine and be your authentic self in the world to share with our community?
Oh, what piece of advice have I been given? I don't know if there's one single bit of advice, you know. I think I'm constantly learning, right? And I take things from lots of really far more learned people than myself. One piece of advice.
To be honest, I think I'd even struggle with this question.
It's a hard one that someone else has given me.
Or diversity advice.
Or diversity advice is a bit different. Somewhat bit of advice that someone has given me. I'm really having to think on that one.
Maybe you can think.
I'm racking my brain. I think there is like advice I've been given, but I couldn't, I don't know, voice it on this podcast because it'd be like, yeah. Keep it on the backside.
Yeah, I think sometimes so every organization, right, is reflective of society. And so I think in society, we still have so many challenges around diversity and inclusion, right? And so many challenges that disproportionately burden, I think, Black and Brown people to solve. So I think one of the best pieces of advice that was given to me was actually by a consultant. She's a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant by the name of Katie Robinson. And she said to me that it is not my burden to have to educate others. It is my burden to educate myself, but it is not my burden to educate other people. I think that was the best piece of advice she gave me as a woman of color, because I think often there is, I'm expected not just to raise the fact that there is a challenge, but also come up with what is the answer to that challenge and what the opportunity is to that challenge. And I think that should be a shared responsibility. So when she said to me, it is not your burden, I think I felt a weight lift. And I think that was probably the best bit of advice someone's given me to be able to continue the kind of justice and equity work that I believe in, and with regards to continuing to shape safe spaces as I, you know, continue in my career and want to progress in it. For me, that's what's most important. Yeah.
Cool.
That's nice.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up there because we're obviously at our time. So, Uma, thank you for obviously joining us today and obviously sharing your story, because that's the whole point of this podcast, is obviously learning about new people, different companies, different roles, and obviously that whole entire journey from, you know, the very early days to present time.
Yeah, thank you very much for including me, for the opportunity to speak, and for amplifying my voice. I really do appreciate that.
I would say casting a spotlight. Yeah, throw the name in there.
When I first moved in Derby, I thought it was a student town, not a city at all. But then I start discovering, and I think thanks to Rolls-Royce, it's been very diverse and inclusive. I can see lots of different people. So thank you very much, Uma, for joining us today.
Cool. And everyone else listening, and happy International Women's Day, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Microsoft Spotlight podcast.
please make sure you hit that like, share and subscribe button to help us promote our message. You can also follow us on Twitter at MSFT Spotlight, and we're also on LinkedIn, the Microsoft Spotlight Podcast. And finally, we'd like to tell you a little bit about BitTitan and thank them for sponsoring this podcast.
Remote migrations start here. Let MigrationWiz do the work for you. It's fast, secure, and 100% SaaS, which means you can migrate at any time and from anywhere. Migrate mailboxes, documents, public folders, personal archives, or even Microsoft Teams with just a few clicks. No special training needed, and no customer downtime. When the work matters, choose MigrationWiz.